From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the allegations against singer-songwriter Ryan Adams tell a broader story about sexual harassment in the music industry. Then the Colombian film Birds of Passage takes a look at the seeds of the international drug trade through the eyes of the indigenous Wayuu people.
This story has been told from the perspective of what happened later, you know, the stories of the cartel, of Pablo Escobar, of the narcos. But the beginning is actually an even more interesting story.
And keep it down. The sound editors from A Quiet Place might hear you. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Since the allegations against disgraced producer and studio executive Harvey Weinstein surfaced, Hollywood has become closely associated with Me Too. The music industry, not yet as much. Now, allegations of sexual abuse by Ryan Adams, the prolific singer-songwriter, have come to light, and those follow new reports implicating singer R. Kelly. Adams is known for his work in the studio as a producer, as well as for his own recordings. He's released 16 albums, earned 7 Grammy nominations, and produced for the likes of Willie Nelson and penned hits for Tim McGraw. But a new story in the New York Times details his pattern of alleged abuse toward female artists, many of them much younger than Adams. Co-author Milena Ryzik shares how the story evolved.
My colleague Joe Coscarilli and I spent about 5 months talking to people who knew Adams. We spoke with 7 women and over a dozen associates who described a pretty disturbing pattern of behavior in which he effectively dangled career opportunities while he pursued female artists for sex. If the relationships didn't go as he wanted, he would sometimes jerk away his support and sort of turn domineering and subject people to psychological and emotional abuse and online harassment. The people that we talked to for the story who had these experiences with him, the youngest was 14 when she first started communicating with him, and you know, they extend all the way to his one-time wife, Mandy Moore.
He has not been charged with anything criminally. Might he potentially be facing some sort of criminal charges?
You know, I'm not a criminal lawyer and not a professional, but it's certainly true that some of the behavior in which he engaged with the underage woman, the online sexual correspondence that they had, might be considered a felony depending on the state which got the jurisdiction for that kind of case.
And what has Ryan Adams said either through his lawyer or on social media about the paper's reporting?
Ryan Adams denied the allegations in our story. Most vociferously, he denied that he had any kind of sexual correspondence knowingly with a woman who was underage. He said that he didn't recall any of the correspondence between himself and this young woman, although we have reviewed thousands of messages between them, 3,217 messages from a 9-month period alone when she was 15 and 16.
There have been a lot of stories about alleged sexual assaults and harassment in the TV and movie world. Executives and producers like Harvey Weinstein, Les Moonves, TV hosts like Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer. There hasn't been a lot of reporting about what's happened in the music business. And I guess this is a little bit of a hypothetical question, but is there more to the music business than we've heard of so far? And what about the whole idea about music being this world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, where what is really impermissible behavior is considered okay?
Yeah, I think absolutely. If you talk to anybody involved in the music world, they will tell you that, though we may not have heard about it in the last year, that inequitable treatment of women and sexual harassment is pervasive in the industry. I mean, what I'm seeing in terms of the reaction from people in the music world, from artists and people who are behind the scenes to this piece, is to say, like, yes, Ryan Adams is one of many, and let's start the conversation about this. And I think you're absolutely right that the idea of sex, drugs, and rock and roll has probably shielded people from being held to account. What's different now is that, you know, until now, people didn't think that they could speak out about it and that anyone would care.
Your story recounts the psychological toll that a lot of this alleged abuse took on these young women, but it also feels as if there was a professional toll and that they lost confidence in themselves and in their music. Did you see that as a theme that was repeated among more than one person?
Absolutely. And I think that's because, you know, it is an insidious way that we lose talent and we lose women who have creative dreams or any kind of ambition in an industry in which, you know, that's dominated by men. Because definitely, you know, this kind of psychological and emotional abuse and manipulation and control absolutely both directly undermined their career in terms of perhaps as in Mandy Moore's case, you know, dissuading her from working with other people when she had Ryan telling her, I'm going to produce your next album, although he never did. All of that stuff has an effect, and it has an effect on people's self-confidence, on their view of themselves as an artist who's worth being listened to, and also literally on their ability to make connections and forge ahead.
Toward the end of your article, you and your co-author Joe Coscarelli say, and I'm quoting now, only recently did the women discover that their experiences overlapped, unquote. I guess I have two questions. Was that a result of your reporting? And what did they find when they discovered that they were not alone? They were part of a group that allegedly had this happen to them.
One of the things that I think is a hallmark of these kind of experiences coming to light is that for years, many women think that they are alone and having these what they perceive to be shameful experiences, and they carry a lot of guilt about, you know, what happened to them, how they put themselves in that situation. And then when they discover, you know, that they weren't alone, that perhaps the person who did this to them was an expert and figured out how to do this to woman after woman after woman, that really turns a key in them. And they realize that, you know, this is part of a pattern of behavior that needs to be discussed. So when that happened for some of these women, when they realized that, you know, they weren't the only one that he was gaslighting or manipulating or feeding lies to, they decided that it was time for them to speak out because they did want to protect other women from having these horrible experiences.
Melena Rysik is a reporter at The New York Times, along with Joe Coscarelli. She is the author of the article, Ryan Adams Dangled Success, Women Say They Paid a Price. Melena, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And you're hearing a song by Phoebe Bridgers called Motion Sickness. It was written about her own troubling experiences with Ryan Adams. Coming up on The Frame, a tragic take on the drug trade in a film from Colombia.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless, and AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Colombia's official Oscar entry for the foreign language film Birds of Passage did not make the final cut of nominees, but it has received plenty of acclaim. The film examines the origins of Colombia's drug trade, but instead of focusing on well-known cartel figures such as Pablo Escobar, Birds of Passage looks at some of the first growers and smugglers in the 1960s and 70s, the indigenous Wayuu people. The film is mainly told in their native language and follows a traditional Wayuu family as it rises to wealth and is then torn apart by the boom of the international drug trade. I spoke with the film's directors, Cristina Gallego and Ciro Guerra, when Birds of Passage debuted last September at the Telluride Film Festival. And Guerra began by explaining why they were drawn to that specific time in history when the drug trade took root in Colombia.
We grew up in the 80s at the end of the Bonanza Marimbera. 10 years ago, we were in the region doing another film. It's called The Wind Journeys. And we start to hear about all the things that happened in this period, because one of the scenes of that film has it was set in that period and has some marimberos there.
A lot of people may have never heard of the Bonanza Marimbera, but it's a period of time where a lot of indigenous people in Colombia started farming marijuana. Why is this period so untold?
For us, it was so interesting because it was the origin story. It's the beginning of everything that would eventually become the international drug trade. And it was just a small story, something that started in a very naive way, and then it became a monster that has essentially become a problem for the whole world. But yet, this story has been told from the perspective of what happened later, you know, the stories of the cartel, of Pablo Escobar, of the narcos, and this is the part of the story that people know about. But the beginning is actually an even more interesting story. How indigenous families that had very little contact with the outside world got swept up in this wave of savage capitalism. And how it became, and how just the demand for marijuana, and how the Santa Marta Gold, which was a very famous strain of marijuana in the 70s, just brought on a new era that would mark our lives for decades as a society.
I'm going to ask you why it was important that you tell the story from the Wayuu's point of view. That this is not like we typically see in any kind of drug story where it's about the American agents or the drug lords, but it's really about the people themselves told in their language. That's clearly very important to you in telling the story.
We choose the Wayuu people, even if they are not the main protagonists. They are the ones who start in Colombia when they used to be smugglers. And they are very traditional and indigenous society, but they are very capitalistic in the way they make commerce with many people, with the Antilles, with all the Caribbean. They used to be smugglers of coffee, whiskey, and cigarettes. And we wanted to talk about this start of the business that was in a very naive way, but that changes the culture. And I think we choose the Wayuu people for many reasons, because first, they have this strong code of behavior and the relation with the world and with the respect and with the honor that make for us a very good place for a gangster movie. But then also because we wanted to make more a metaphor from our society, our nation, but in a close community.
Yeah, I just want to add that usually when this story is told, it's told from a point of view that ends up glorifying the criminals. And it's never about what this process has meant to us as a society. So being able to tell this story from this perspective gave us that notion in which it's not about the glorification of gangsters or criminals, but about the damage that this process has done to us as a society.
One of the things that's very important in the telling of your film is dreams, that dreams are ways that the Wayuu anticipate omens, the way they speak to ancestors, the way they see their future. And as the story continues, the dreams go away. And the dreams at the beginning of the film are evidence of the soul. And as the dreams go away, so too does the soul. And that's kind of an element of magical realism that I think will remind some people of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Why is that such an important part of your story, and why are dreams so important to the Wayuu?
Yes, the dreams are a capital thing for the Wayuu people. The dreams tell you what will happen, is the way to communicate with the ancestors. And we wanted to have all this magic realism, but was also the fight between reality and in consciousness through the dreams and through all these magic events and the relation with the birds and what happened in your mind and between the powers in the family, in the male aspects and in the female aspects. And yes, it has many layers to develop.
Yeah, one thing people don't know about that much is that García Márquez is from this region, and a lot of his imaginary, a lot of what you read in his novels is inspired by the mythology of the Wayuu. He was raised by Wayuu servants. So a big part of his family was Wayuu. So the way these people interpret and see the world is something that is definitely a big source of what he eventually developed into the literary world as magic realism.
We're talking with Cristina Gallego and Ciro Guerra. They're the co-directors of the film Birds of Passage. I want to ask you about beauty in this film. This is a film that has a lot of violence and a lot of heartbreak and a lot of sadness in it. And yet as filmmakers, you're also trying to shoot the film in a very beautiful way. There's beautiful shots, there's beautiful music. How did you figure out how lyrical and beautiful this film would be, even as you're exploring a very dark and violent period of history?
That's something that is common to our films. I think we think the world is sort of the clash between these two, especially the way we experience it in Colombia. Colombia is a tremendously beautiful country in which nature is so powerful and it's everywhere. And also, you know, there's such terrible acts of violence happening all the time, and the society itself can be so violent. And how these two things clash and collide, and it's just an amazing experience of the world. And we think our films should be faithful to that. Since we're dealing with the Wayuu people's point of view, they have a strong relationship to nature, and they have a strong connection to the earth, and they interpret everything. The birds have a meaning, the way they come and go, the winds, the way the rains come. And so the film is faithful to that relationship with the world. And so we shot the film in natural light. We shot the film with an organic format, 35 millimeter, in order to give you an organic feel of this place and the relationship that the Wayuu people have with it.
This film is set in a very isolated corner of Colombia. And yet when you come with a movie like this to Telluride, there are people like Damien Chazelle, who made La La Land and First Man, who are talking about how much they love your movie. Yorgos Lanthimos, who made The Favorite, is talking about your movie. What is it like to be able to show your movie, not just to the audience, but other filmmakers who respect your work so much?
It means a lot for us. I think this is a beautiful and wonderful place to start the life of the film here in the U.S. We wanted bigger audiences here or outside. For us, is the most important thing is tell the history about what happens there from our point of view. We think that a history of the narco traffic from Colombia has been told from outside, and we think that this film brings another point of view, and a point of view from us that we were more like a protagonist of this problem in the world. So it's important for us to bring this history.
The Wayuu people are historically cut off from kind of modern Colombia. In the telling of your film, the most modern things they encounter are almost weapons. Have you had a chance to bring your film back to the Wayuu people? Because you cast a lot of Wayuu people who are not professional actors as actors in this film, and if you've taken it to them, what was that experience like?
Yeah, we had the commitment that they were going to be the first ones to see it in Colombia. So the premiere was there. We had a premiere under the stars, and the biggest town that they have, it's called Uribia. And it was a wonderful evening. We brought us a big screen, and we had like 400 seats, but more like 2,000 people showed up, you know, from the children to the elderly. And everyone brought seats from their home, and there was no light, no electricity that night. So the only light was coming from the screen. It was a really, and they really embraced the film. They really loved the film. It reminded them of many things of this period, but they were just so happy and proud to be able to see their own language on screen, their own culture, their you know, their beautiful costumes, how amazing they are, and they were really happy, and they were also, you know, they were getting, there are many things in the film that only they can really understand. You know, whenever a bird would show up, they would know exactly what it would mean. And they were all laughing all the time with the film. They were, you know, constantly embarked with the film. And it was just one of the best screenings that we have had.
Ciro and Cristina, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for your invitation.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a wonderful experience. And we're looking forward to sharing the film with all of American audiences.
Cristina Gallego and Ciro Guerra are the co-directors of Birds of Passage. It opens in select theaters on February 15th. Coming up on The Frame, how the sound editors of A Quiet Place created terror amidst all that silence.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The countdown is on to the Academy Awards, and so is the countdown to our annual preview of the Oscars. I'm joined by co-host Rebecca Keegan from The Hollywood Reporter, and you'll hear from many of the top nominees, including Rami Malek, Glenn Close, Rachel Weisz, Spike Lee, and Alfonso Cuarón. The first airings of our Oscar preview are this Saturday at 11 p.m. and Sunday at 8 p.m. right here on 89.3. KPCC. And now, John Krasinski was the director and co-writer of the movie A Quiet Place, and he co-starred in the film with his real-life wife, Emily Blunt. But the other star of the movie is its sound design, because the whole plot is predicated on a world where any noise you make could mean sudden death. As The Frame contributor Tim Grieving demonstrates, it's easy to see why the two sound editors on the film are nominated for an Oscar.
In its most sort of basic, broad description, sound editing is the collection and creation of the sounds. So that includes recording, sound design, Foley, sound effects, and putting that all together into picture. My name is Eric Adol.
My name is Ethan Van der Rijn.
You know, sound editors are kind of like composers. We're following this family that has to survive by understanding sound. There are these creatures that have hyperacute hearing. So in a way, sound kind of becomes a central character in this story and creates this experience that, ideally, and this was our goal, would put the audience into the shoes of the characters and make them active participants in this experience. So basically, Emily's character, Evelyn, her water has broken. So the baby is impending, which you can imagine in this world is kind of a nightmare. And a creature has sensed that there's some activity going on. So it comes down into the basement to sniff her out. This is Emily's breathing from set, but also supplemented with some ADR, which we recorded in the studio. So everything else is completely reconstructed in post-production sound. So Emily has just found this egg timer, which she's going to use as a sonic diversion. And there we hear the creature approaching. These creatures are essentially blind, so they use their sound perception to navigate through the world. And so we immediately thought of creatures that use echolocation and sonar, like bats and dolphins. And in our experimental process of creating the sound, started with those more literal animal sounds, but found that they were a little too recognizable, and we wanted something a little more alien. And we stumbled upon a prop that we have here in the shop, which is an electrical stun gun, which makes these clicking sounds that we can kind of perform like a musical instrument using grapes. So we can kind of manipulate the stun gun against the grape, which is very much like, you know, human skin. It's got a thin skin on it and a fleshy interior that conducts the electricity. And we slowed those stun gun clicks down about 75%. And those are the clicks that you hear here for the creature searching. So those are the stair creaks as it's coming down into the basement. So our egg timer is going. And we're about to hear the egg timer from the creature's point of view. Its ears now open up. One of the principal characters, the daughter Regan, is deaf. So we thought, okay, how do we tell her experience using sound? We wanted to create her sonic point of view, which John Krasinski came to call her sonic envelope. Regan was played by Millicent Simmons, who is deaf in real life. And she described through her mom, who's her translator, her experience of what it's like to hear using a cochlear implant. And it's kind of this low rumble and a faint kind of pulse of, you know, her heart and circulatory system. So this was kind of the first scene where we experimented with going into her sonic envelope. So now we're inside her head in her sonic perception, and we see behind her a creature emerging from the corn. She can't hear it, and it can't see her. So now the creature's ears open up, and we hear its heightened perception. And there's the feedback sound now happening, and we cut to Millie, and she's hearing that now. And it creates pain for both the creature and her. And ultimately repels the creature. We also establish a key plot point through sound that there's some kind of electrical interference between these creatures and her cochlear implant, which gets paid off, you know, in the climax of the film later on.
Reporting from inside the very unquiet work studio of Eric Adahl and Ethan van der Rijn, the Oscar-nominated sound editors for A Quiet Place, for The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite. Now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and best picture of the year. Now playing.